Then he stopped and looked back toward the tunnel exit. Kennard, then Gray, then the others behind them emerged in close succession. It was like their heads and feet were almost connected. They resembled to Blaine a huge, mud-splattered crocodile, and he almost laughed at the curious but exhilarating spectacle. As he reached the stand of rye, some fallen stalks rustled beneath him. Even with the steady beat of rain, the sound met Blaine's ears like a series of small detonations. He waited at the edge of the field for Gray and Kennard to reach him. In whispers, they debated advancing into the rye versus crawling along its edge until they were far enough away from the camp. Taking charge, Gray made the decision to proceed directly through the stalks. It was the quickest way, and he was sure that the rainfall and wind would sufficiently drown out the noise of the stalks underfoot. The three threaded their way into the rye field, with Blaine convinced the guard would soon hear their movements and set the dogs on their trail. When no cry of alarm was raised, he relaxed enough to straighten up from his crouched walk and hasten his pace. After traversing the rye field, they came to the main road that ran between Holzminden and Aarholzen, the nearest town to the northwest. They knew, from the reports of their German accomplices, that during the night the police patrolled the stretch of road on bicycles, and they waited at the side of the road until they were sure the coast was clear. Then Gray led them northward, through more fields of rye and corn, to the top of a low hill. They dropped their rucksacks to the ground and took a brief rest. They had been on the run for a half hour. In the distance, the town of Holzminden looked to be floating in a sea of surrounding darkness. They could not distinguish the two barracks blocks, which seemed to blur together as one. The three officers savored their freedom at last. They were masters of their own fate again. The air they breathed never tasted fresher. The hunk of Kaylee's marching chocolate never sweeter. "Bet Niemeyer wouldn't be sleeping so well if he knew where we were," Blaine said. "Let's hope nothing disturbs his slumbers until morning," Kennard replied. "Just let's make sure," Gray said. "We never see that bastard again." They let the thought linger, then tramped down the hill to the Weser. The river served as a natural barrier to any escape westward. Bridges over it were routinely patrolled. And its fast, deep waters had delayed, or altogether foiled, earlier runs from Holzminden. They needed to cross to its opposite bank before first light of dawn, at roughly 4:30 a.m. Otherwise, they were sure to be recaptured. Chapter 20. Charles Rathbone thrust his body into the tunnel, the fit almost as tight as a cork pushed back into a bottle. The already stout officer had been made stouter by the pair of suits he wore. One was to be thrown away after the trip through the tunnel. The other was his disguise, a German civilian on a cross-country train journey. He had only once before been down into the sap, and had never made the passage through its full length. He was quite unaccustomed to the claustrophobic environment and the effort it took to crawl through. The fact that his face was almost level with the dirt floor only deepened the horror. Nonetheless, he kept pushing himself forward, grunting and sweating as he went. Behind him, Jim Bennett was like a racehorse stalled behind a mule. But there was no way around the senior officer, nor could Bennett do anything about the walls and roof of the tunnel being abraded by Rathbone's movement. Alerted to the all-clear at midnight, Bennett and Campbell Martin had hurried down through the orderly quarters and into the chamber. They were the 15th and 16th men into the tunnel. Despite Rathbone's troubles, he was not the first to disturb the already marginal structural integrity of their burrow. With their kits and their eagerness to reach the exit, some of the officers who had gone before had knocked out struts, loosened rocks that had been dug around long before, and left chunks of dirt, as well as tins of food fallen from their rucksacks, along the path. Once the ruck arrived, the state of the tunnel would surely deteriorate further. After over an hour in the tunnel, Rathbone finally squirmed free. Stretched out in the bean rows, he was certain he could hear the sentry breathing. Bennett rose from the sap after him, followed by Campbell Martin. They wished each other well. Then Rathborn wriggled on his belly into the rye stalks. Once deep inside the field, he lifted up to his hands and knees and continued on. Such was the denseness of the cornfield beyond that he found himself almost trapped in the midst of its narrow rows. Finally, he broke free, crossed a cabbage field, and brazenly hiked alongside the road that led south from Holtzminden. If stopped, he believed he had a good chance of talking his way out of the situation. The others were headed west, the direction in which Niemeyer, when alerted to the escape, would immediately begin the search. Rathborn had decided to go the opposite way. He planned to catch the first of several trains toward Holland in Göttingen, 35 miles to the southeast. Bennett and Campbell Martin made their way through the same rye and cornfields as Rathborn had traversed, but traveling much more quickly and in the opposite direction. Their route might be the first to attract a search party's attention, but they intended to move at such a pace that no one had a chance of catching up with them. In Block B, Durnford made his rounds, alerting members of the ruck about when they could take their turn at escape now that the core team of tunnelers were out. At 12:45 a.m., he knocked at the door of 34-year-old Jack Morrow of the Royal Irish Regiment, number 22 on the list. "Your turn, Major, and God bless you," Durnford said. Morrow thanked him and rushed up the two flights of stairs to the attic. In the attic room, Grieve told the Major he would have to wait a bit longer. Someone was stuck in the tunnel. Morrow hunkered down beside the dormer window, listening to the gale outside and the intermittent rain. Now and again he looked out the window to watch the German guards on their rounds. Little did the one stationed outside the wall know that at that very moment there were men tunneling through the earth directly under his feet. "All clear," an orderly announced from the eaves. Grieve allowed Morrow and several other officers to pass. They crept along the length of the barracks, down the stairs, and into the chamber. After shaking hands with a fellow Irishman, Corporal McKay, Morrow entered the tunnel for the first time. Following a quick descent of the initial slope, he found himself in the pitch black. The tightness of the space did not surprise him as much as the noise. The long snake of men ahead of him, their heavy breathing, wriggling bodies, clanging kit bags and curses, made for an awful din. He wondered how the guard above could fail to hear them. Morrow inched forward. The passage was in sorrowful shape. He wrestled past broken struts and piles of dirt and stone. Just as he began to gather some kind of rhythm, using his grip on his rucksack to pull himself forward, he felt like he hit a wall. Then the wall started to move. The man in front of him was clearly trying to worm his way backward. Morrow tried to shout at him, but with his face inches from the damp earth, his voice was muffled. Stuck and panicking, the man ahead thrashed about, kicking his legs and twisting back and forth. Meanwhile, the officer behind pushed at Morrow's heels. Caught between the two, Morrow was terrified. Finally, the individual ahead jerked his way free, and Morrow began crawling again. He was tired, desperate for some fresh air, and harried by the continuous noise of men. He managed only a few feet before he encountered a large stone blocking his path. The officer in front must have dislodged it in his panic. Using his rucksack, he shoved the stone a few inches forward, hoping he might find the place on the tunnel's wall where it had broken loose. If it had fallen from above, there was no hope. Bracing his legs, he thrust against the stone again, then again, then again. He was damaging the sides of the tunnel, but he had no choice. Feeling with his hands, he discovered the slot where the stone had separated from the wall. With one last shove, he returned it to its place. The tunnel was disintegrating with the ruck's every movement. Morrow feared he might never find his way out. David Gray scanned the banks of the Weser for the narrowest point to cross. The storm had tossed and roiled the black waters, which looked like an ocean between them and the opposite shore. As he scouted ahead, Kennard spotted a dilapidated fence bordering a nearby field, and had an idea. He started breaking off slats. Blaine joined him. Roped together, the wood could serve as a makeshift raft for their clothes and rucksacks. By the time they had gathered enough pieces, Gray had found a point to begin their swim. It would still be at least 140 yards across to the other bank. The three stripped down to their underwear, bound their clothes up, and placed everything on the roped-together fence slats. Their watches, before they too went into their rucksacks, read 2:15 a.m. The men were already soaked through by the rain when they slipped into the tepid water. The shifting clouds overhead cast the river alternately in darkness and moonlight. Fearing a patrol, they waited for cloud cover before pushing away from the bank. They swam furiously for the other side, each holding onto a side of the raft to keep it steady. Waves swept over their heads, and by the movement of the trees on the opposite shore, they could tell that the currents were dragging them swiftly downstream. On they went, kicking their legs and swinging their arms. Halfway across, they were already breathing heavily, their limbs weary. A whitecap almost pitched over their raft, but they managed to keep it afloat. Desperation, and nothing else, drove them to reach the western shore. Finally, they climbed onto the banks and collapsed with relief. After taking a moment to recover from their exertions, they emptied the raft. The wind and rain chilled them to the bone as they dressed again in their damp clothes. Kennard dragged the raft up the bank a few hundred yards to throw off the German bloodhounds that were sure to follow on their trail. Gray suggested that they march as far north as possible that night, believing that the search area would concentrate on the forests west of the Weser. Blaine and Kennard agreed. At first, they followed the road bordering the river. Although it ran a sharp, serpentine course, Gray figured the extra distance on the road could be covered far faster than tramping a direct line northward through forests and muck-mired fields. Gray and Blaine both carried heavy rucksacks with their food stores, biscuits, black bread, OXO cubes, and tins of ham and tongue, and other key supplies. Kennard carried their reserve kit, containing extra clothing, tobacco, and chocolate. If they happened on anyone along the way, he would have to ditch it quickly. A madman on the run would not be expected to have provisions. By 3:30 a.m. they had circumvented Heinzen. Outside the town, they shed their pajamas and stashed them in some reeds. They had managed to keep their outfits underneath clean. The small village of Pola was empty as they walked down its main street. A dog barked at their presence, but otherwise they passed through unnoticed. A half hour later they reached another riverside hamlet, Brifurda. Its scattering of old cottages, their walls bulging from settlement over time, looked dark and abandoned. With dawn approaching, they marched a little farther north before veering off the road into some thick woods to hide out during the daylight hours. They were roughly 9 miles from Holzminden, a distance they hoped gave them a sufficient head start after the alarm was raised. The men ate a light meal, a tin of ham and some black bread, and smoked cigarettes. Blaine got a good chuckle when he shared with them his observation of how the men streaming out of the tunnel had looked like a crocodile emerging from the earth. He volunteered to take the first watch. Exhausted, Gray and Kennard assented and went quickly to sleep. Blaine stared out into the surrounding darkness of the woods. When Bennett and Campbell Martin arrived at the Weser, they came upon John Bousfield. In the scramble outside the tunnel, Bousfield had lost his traveling companion, Peter Lyon, and reluctantly decided to go on ahead alone. The three officers undressed and bundled their clothes into their rucksacks, which they tied to their waist with ropes. Then they began across the rough waters. An unsteady swimmer at best, Campbell Martin soon found himself overwhelmed by the fast current. Together, Bennett and Bousfield dragged him to shore. After dressing, they struggled through a cornfield, following the same route to Heinsen that Gray had chosen. Once past the town, they abandoned the road and headed into the forested hills to the west. Although Bousfield had been a champion three-mile runner at Cambridge, he was hard-pressed to maintain the pace set by Bennett, whose long, loping stride seemed to eat up the ground underneath him. After a few miles, as daylight crept over the eastern horizon, he finally slowed. Bousfield argued that they would have a better chance at evading discovery if they bedded down in some farmland. A field of rye would provide superior cover, he argued, and they would be alerted to the presence of any pursuers by the crackling of their footsteps through the stalks. Convinced, the three hiked onward until they found a stretch of rye. 6 miles south of Holtzminden, Charles Rathbone bedded down alone in a fir plantation, next to a spring of water. He watched the sun break into the sky before resting his head on his small bag and falling into a fitful sleep. There was trouble in the tunnel. Lieutenant Edgar Garland, a New Zealand-born pilot, was halfway through when the man in front of him stopped moving. Garland rattled his boot, but the officer did not react. Perhaps he had fainted, Garland thought. He had a flashlight, but its narrow beam did not penetrate far into the twisting burrow. "What's the idea?" he shouted. "Having a rest?" "The tunnel has fallen in, and they are trying to clear it," the man in front finally called back. "It will only take a few minutes." Garland rested his head down in the dirt and tried to calm his breathing. The air was already bad from all the men crowded down in the hole. If there was a blockage, it was sure to get worse. Moments later, he felt someone jamming up against his feet. The chain of officers behind had caught up. "What's wrong?" a voice at his feet gasped weakly. Garland explained, confident that the obstruction would soon be cleared, and he would begin his home run to Holland. But the obstruction would not be cleared. Several feet shy of the exit, the sap had caved in completely. A number of officers had made it through, including Jack Morrow, but now dirt and stone had cascaded down the slope and rendered it impassable. Major Marcus Hartigan, a 38-year-old veteran of the Boer War and next in line to break out, only just managed to scramble backward before being buried alive. His desperate attempts to reopen the face of the hole with his hands in the inky darkness were fruitless. There was too much earth blocking his path. If he was to survive, then the men behind him needed to abandon their escape and push themselves back out of the tunnel before oxygen ran out. There were more than a dozen of them in the hole. Back at the sap's midway point, Garland waited 15 minutes, then half an hour. Nobody was moving. And from the gurgling sound echoing through the sap, the men were starving for oxygen. With his own arms weakening, he was sure he was suffering the same. Now and again he flicked on his flashlight for some relief from the impenetrable darkness. Thoughts of death pervaded. He had almost lost hope when he sensed the officer behind him finally retreating. Garland followed, hauling his rucksack behind him. Time and again the line halted. The men's strength was depleted, and their coats and kits kept snagging on rocks. After much strain, Garland reached the long slope that ran up toward the tunnel entrance. He might as well have tried to climb a cliff backward. Then someone grabbed his legs and pulled him out. Alerted to the cave-in, Durnford and Grieve had organized a chain of men to haul bodies from the tunnel as they neared the chamber. The first concern was to get everybody out alive. The second was to do so before 6 a.m., an hour fast approaching, when a guard would unlock the doors and send the orderlies out on their duties. If they failed to clear the sap, and if men were still moving about the orderly quarters, they risked the breakout being discovered long before the morning roll call at 9 a.m. 3 hours could prove the difference between escape or recapture for those officers who had safely made it out. Some in the ruck had fainted or were too weak to evacuate the tunnel on their own. Garland volunteered to drag them out. With great effort and risk of falling victim to another collapse, he crawled deep into the tunnel again. he managed to muscle one officer after another back through the hole. Shortly before 6 a.m., he had helped out all but Hartigan and the officer behind him. He and a few others remained in the chamber to retrieve them while the orderlies and officers snuck back to their rooms and removed any signs of their nighttime activity. From the windows, Durnford watched for any hint that the breakout had been discovered, but the guards walked their normal rounds. The man might yet make it to the first roll call without any alarm being raised. A half hour later, they succeeded in extracting Hartigan and the other officer. Neither was in great shape, but they were breathing. While they recovered, Garland and the others crept back up the stairwell, across the eaves, and into their own quarters. Soon after, Hartigan and the other officer came straight out of the eastern orderly door of Block B. They should have returned to their rooms through the attic, like the others had done, but after their experience in the tunnel, they were not thinking straight. As they crossed to the cookhouse, guards seized them. Officers were not allowed onto the parade ground before 7 a.m., and certainly not officers exiting the orderly quarters in muddy clothes. Minutes later, Niemeyer stormed up to them, demanding to know what they were about. Neither answered. The standoff was interrupted by the arrival at the eastern postern gate of a red-faced and clearly incensed farmer, complaining that a parade of men had stamped about his fields in the night, ruining his crops. Niemeyer and his guards followed the farmer out of the gate and found the hole dug in the earth between the rows of beans. "So, a tunnel!" Niemeyer exclaimed. He turned to one of his lieutenants, a man called Mandelbrot, and ordered him to lock down the camp to determine how many prisoners had escaped. While the guard headed for the barracks, Niemeyer ordered another guard to climb down into the tunnel to find its starting point. The guard eyed the gaping hole, then his commandant, and shook his head. "There might be officers still in the sap," he said. Next, Niemeyer tried to send his dog into the opening, but the animal balked at the order as well. Niemeyer strode off to the commandantur. He rang the local police, the town's garrison commander, and finally, General Hainisch in Hanover. A manhunt needed to be launched. No effort could be spared. Mandelbrot had locked both barracks and restricted all the prisoners to their rooms. He had never much cared for Commandant Niemeyer and his constant derision, and as he went about the corridors counting the men, he could barely suppress a thin smile as silence met his calling out the name of officer after officer. Murmurs of excitement from the prisoners followed him through the barracks. "The tunnel has gone, boys," one British officer crowed to his roommates. A grand escape had indeed come off. The only question was how many had managed to get away. Mandelbrot finished his count and went to meet Niemeyer in the Spielplatz. 29, Herr Captain. From a barracks window, Durnford watched the scene unfold. Later, he vividly described the moment. Niemeyer's jaw dropped, his mustachios for a brief instant lost their twirl, his solid stomach swelled less impressively against his overcoat. Just for a moment he became gray and looked very old, but only for a moment. Then Niemeyer went beet red. He cursed and kicked the ground and shook his fists at the officers watching him from the windows. When they started to jeer at him, he ordered his guards to shoot at anyone appearing at the glass. Several shots were fired, but, accustomed to Niemeyer's tactics, officers in the crosshairs were able to evade the gunfire. Niemeyer ordered guards to be posted at the tunnel exit and beside the locked doors of the barracks. Nobody was allowed out for any reason, and any officers gathering near the windows were to be shot. He charged his lieutenants with locating the tunnel entrance by any means necessary, even if they had to dig up its entire length. Throughout the barracks, the officers reverently repeated the number of men who had made it out of the camp. 29, 29. It was the greatest breakout of the war, the greatest, perhaps, in the history of war. Chapter 21. Hunkered in a stand of corn stalks on Wednesday, July 24th, Bennett listened to the distant voices of the search parties and their barking dogs as they scoured the woods a quarter mile away. Now and again, some ventured closer to the field where he hid with Campbell Martin and Bousfield, but they dared not move during daylight hours. A couple of horse-drawn carts carrying soldiers also passed on the nearby road. The hunt was intensifying, and from previous experience, they knew that the German army would have informed the surrounding villages about the escape, asking civilians to be on the alert. Unless they put many miles between them and Holzminden, and soon, the net would continue to tighten. Still, they remained in the fields, anxious and unable to sleep. Only when it was well after dark did they continue, moving as quietly as possible through the forest. It was a starless night, and they had trouble maintaining their compass course. They soon found themselves lost in a gully, and were forced to backtrack through the dark woods until they again found the right path. At one point they spotted someone they feared was a German soldier, carrying a large backpack. They tried to evade him, only to hear him call out in English. It was Philip Murphy Smith, a 22-year-old Irish cavalry officer and member of the ruck. The small group started out for Hummerson, down a road bordered by thick forests, when two men emerged from the trees in front of them. It was Mardoch and Lawrence, who had recently come to a crossroads and were confused as to which direction to take. They informed the others that Major Morrow was a short distance away. When Morrow caught up with them, they numbered seven. The area was seemingly crawling with escaped prisoners. The men huddled together in the woods, sharing stories of the breakout. Morrow regaled them with his adventures of the past few hours, including accidentally setting his entire tin of matches on fire, almost being stumbled upon by a woman and her two children foraging in the woods, where he lay naked while his clothes dried, and awakening in mid-afternoon, standing in a clearing in full view of anyone who might be there. For the first time in his life, at the most inopportune moment, he'd found himself sleepwalking. His fellow officers chortled at these stories, and their voices and laughter grew louder as they engaged in welcome camaraderie, billows of cigarette smoke rising from their midst. Finally, the men put an end to the careless banter. They needed to put as much distance between themselves and Holzminden as possible. It was too dangerous to travel in such a large pack, they decided, so they split apart. Bennett said goodbye once again to his former pilot Lawrence and the others before he and Campbell Martin started off on their own. They had fallen far short of their anticipated pace of 10 miles a night. Heavy rucksacks digging into their shoulders, Gray, Kennard, and Blaine threaded through a forest in the dark. They kept to a single file, keen for any sound other than the call of nightbirds or the skitter of a squirrel through the underbrush. The three had started that day's march before dusk, balancing the risk of being seen against the benefits of getting beyond the 10-mile radius in which they expected Niemeyer to concentrate his manhunt during its first 24 hours. Where they could, they followed the roads, but these tended not to be straight, and often directed them toward some hamlet or town they needed to avoid. They also found themselves hiking through fields and patches of forest. In his many years in the military, Gray had become a skilled orienteer, and his steady compass bearings saved them from the many misdirections and lost time suffered by their fellow fugitives. Shortly after midnight, they reached the hamlet of Gellerson, a distance of roughly 15 miles from Holzminden. On the outskirts, a farmer spotted the trio, too late for them to turn back, hurry into a field, or otherwise find cover. They continued, hoping that Gellerson's main street would be abandoned at that hour, much like the other villages they had passed that night. To their surprise, they found the opposite was true. Oil lamps flickered in many of the windows, and huddles of Germans stood outside their cottages, clearly on edge. The three pilots were sure that news of the Holzminden escape had reached Gellerson, and that the villagers were alarmed by the possibility of an enemy fugitive in their midst. It was time for the men to put their aliases to the test. Before reaching the first house, Kennard had slipped his rucksack to Blaine. Blaine and Gray then bookended Kennard, each with a firm hand on his arms. Kennard made the occasional effort to pull away from their grasp, whereupon his two minders would wrench him back in line. Gray never hesitated as they advanced through Gellerson. Unless they were stopped, he did not intend to explain their presence. He was on official business, with the papers to back him up. Conversations halted as the three passed, and they felt the eyes of every villager on them. Whispers and murmurs followed in their wake, and soon a number of townspeople were trailing after them. A confrontation was inevitable. Gray knew, but the closer they were to the far side of town, when it occurred, the better opportunity they would have to run off if, or when, it came to that point. Throughout, Kennard struggled against his escorts, and occasionally rolled his eyes wildly. When they reached the last cottage, a few villagers finally crossed their path, forcing them to stop. Gray drew out his papers, his identity card in the name of Franz Vogel, and the letter stating his duties as chief guard at the Fekta Insane Asylum. With a glance toward his increasingly agitated charge, Gray recounted in perfect German how the man he was escorting, Kurt Grau, had recently absconded from the asylum and should be given a wide berth. This had the intended effect on some of the villagers, but Gray was concerned about any doubters in the crowd. He asked to be provided some water. His charge was prone to convulsions, he said, and the low growl rising from Grau's throat was an indication that one was coming on quickly. A quietening drug should calm him. On cue, Kennard tried to break loose. Blaine grabbed his arm and knocked him roughly on the side of the head. Gasps of shock rose from a few of the villagers, while one ran off to fetch some water. Playing to his audience now, Kennard whimpered and shook, as if he had no control over his limbs. Gray explained to the onlookers that they could only travel by night, since encounters such as this one only set the lunatic off. When the villager returned with a glass of water, Blaine put his hand out to bar him, leaning over to Gray and briefly whispering in his ear. Gray nodded. "No glass," he explained to the man. "Grau might break it and use the shards as a weapon." With that, they had the villagers completely fooled. A pewter mug of water was found, while Kennard thrashed about like his tunic was on fire. He managed to give Blaine a blow in revenge before being wrestled to the street. Blaine and Gray pinned him down by his arms and legs. He only fought harder until a pill, aspirin, was forced between his lips and washed down with the water. Sparing no drama, Kennard continued to writhe underneath Blaine and Gray as it took effect. With every moment, he seemed to grow weaker, his twitches more spasmodic, like a condemned man dangling from the end of a rope. Finally, he was still. The villagers looked on in shock, but Gray promised that the patient would awaken in a short while, no worse off than he was before. During the wait, Gray and Blaine enjoyed some wine, bread, and cheese from an elderly farmer, who clearly had taken seriously the request from Fechta's chief of police, as stated in the men's papers, to give the guards Vogel and Holtzmann all possible help in bringing Grau back to the asylum. They also gained some useful intelligence from the villagers. A manhunt was underway for some allied POWs, and a company of soldiers was in the area. They were searching the countryside and guarding the road and railway line due north of Gellerson. The two guards could not have been more grateful for the insight. Finally, Kennard fluttered his eyes awake, and Gray and Blaine assisted him off the street. Together they led their groggy patient away. Once clear of the village, they celebrated their success, although Kennard bemoaned the ill treatment his role had demanded of him. He was especially disappointed that his minders had not saved him so much as a crumb of the bread and cheese they'd been given. By the morning of July 25th, none of the fugitives had been caught, and Niemeyer vented his rage on those who remained behind. He instituted new emergency orders, stating that they were for the safety of the prisoners. However, The list posted on the cookhouse wall and on the doors of the barracks reflected camp-wide punishment. 1. No officer of Block A was allowed to enter Block B for any purpose, and vice versa. Penalty for violation? 3 days in isolation. 2. No officer was permitted to enter any room but his own for any purpose. Penalty, 3 days. 3. No officer was allowed to stop, loiter in the passages. Penalty, 3 days. 4. Parole walks stopped. 5. Theatrical performances forbidden. 6. Baths closed. 7. Parcel and tin room shuttered. 8. Activities in the Spielplatz stopped. Lieutenant Colonel Arthur Stokes Roberts, now the senior British officer at the camp, asked Niemeyer to lift the restrictions, which allowed the prisoners to do nothing more than eat, sleep, and breathe. "Go away," Niemeyer barked. "I do not like you. I forbid you to speak to me or any of my lieutenants." The new rules were almost impossible to follow to the letter, and a dozen officers were sent to the jug by the end of the first day. Niemeyer made the rat-infested cells even more uncomfortable by covering the windows with boards, keeping the electric light burning day and night, and sending a guard into every cell once an hour to see that the prisoner was present. Then there were the arbitrary abuses. A guard shoved an officer down the stairs for not moving fast enough. Lights in both barracks would suddenly be turned on in the middle of the night, and any officer who tried to switch them off was sent to solitary. An Australian private questioned a guard about a new order and was hauled off to the cellar for 2 days without bedding, food, or drink. Upset over this treatment, one officer dropped a plank of wood out his window, narrowly missing Niemeyer. In typical response, guards randomly fired into the block. Most resistance, however, was passive. Officers showed up to roll call in unbuttoned uniforms, or without boots, or tunics. They refused to salute or respond to German commands. This incensed Niemeyer, and he had his guards charge a line of officers, one of whom was stabbed with a bayonet. He grew even more furious when it was revealed that the tunnel entrance, whose location was only determined by digging up the entire length of the sap, had been right under the noses of his guards for months. His rage festered when the residents of Holzminden began coming to the camp to see the great tunnel and to wonder aloud how it could have gone unnoticed. A photographer even came to take pictures of the scar of upturned earth that led from the field to the eastern entrance of Block B. No amount of punishment seemed capable of satisfying Niemeyer. He was obsessed with recapturing all 29 of the escapees. Such a mass breakout would not only be an embarrassment to Germany, it would prove ruinous to Niemeyer's career. As part of his campaign to find them, he posted notices in local and national newspapers to ask for cooperation. "We urgently and under all circumstances request help to get hold of all escaped officers in the interest of the defense of our country. We particularly call on the country populations, berry pickers, hay collectors, youth military groups, hikers and hunters, to look out for anything suspicious. We know from experience that fugitives tend to hide in forests. At night, one should watch out for any noise, and especially the barking of dogs in villages. A high reward is promised for assistance." The reward offered was 5,000 marks, a considerable sum in war-torn Germany, for any information that led to the capture of a Holzminden prisoner, dead or alive. On Thursday afternoon, Rathborn attempted to bed down in a stand of woods for some desperately needed rest, but he found little reprieve from the biting ants that crawled down his collar and up his pant legs. Bouts of rain dampened his clothes, but there was never enough to collect. He was not yet so desperate to drink from puddles, but he soon would be. Finally, the sun set, and he started off again on his hike south to Göttingen. The woods were empty but for a soldier and his girlfriend, who were in the middle of undressing as Rathborn passed. The young woman caught his eye, but a simple Kutenacht kept the two lovers to their embraces. Rathborn continued on. By dawn, on the 26th, he was within a dozen miles of Göttingen. His boots and pants were soaked from walking through the rugged countryside, damp with morning dew. Discretion should have kept him in hiding during daylight hours, but the thought of another ant assault and a hot afternoon without fresh water drove him to take only a short rest before continuing. With any luck, he could catch a train that evening. After brushing off his suit, straightening his hair, and doing whatever else he could do to make himself look presentable, he hiked along the road. By 3 p.m., he was headed into the outskirts of Göttingen. Set on the river Leine, Göttingen was a university town, surrounded by ramparts. On his way into its town center, Rathborn came across a tavern. He wanted to test out his ability to pass as a German civilian, but more than that, he needed something for his parched throat. He figured that as long as he kept any talk brief, nobody would be any the wiser that German was not his mother tongue. The tavern's owner, an old woman who looked as much a part of the place as the scuffed bar, slid him a beer. Rathborn had drunk fine quality draughts in the past, in Berlin and Munich, but none tasted better in his lifetime than that beer that afternoon. Furthermore, his short conversation with the barkeep boosted his confidence that he could pass himself off as German. After leaving the tavern, Rathborn walked on, but without a map of the town, he soon found himself lost in its tangle of streets. Half-timbered houses and steepled churches abounded in every direction. It would not do to ask for directions, even if he figured it unlikely that the manhunt would extend to Göttingen. Finally, he came to a sign pointing to the station. Along the way, he dropped into a stationery store that was sure to have a train timetable. There would be too many authorities, police and soldiers alike, to risk wandering about the train station. When he arrived, he wanted to buy his ticket and board straight away. There was a 5 o'clock train south to Bebra. From there, he should be able to find a connection farther south to Fulda, then one due west to Cologne. If he had any luck, he could be out of German territory within 36 hours at most. Shortly before his train was due to depart, he headed through the rounded stone entrance of Göttingen's main station. At the ticket window, valise in hand, he bought a ticket to Bebra. The clerk did not pay him a second glance. But when he showed his ticket to the gate attendant, he was informed that there was no 5 o'clock train to Bebra. His confusion seemed to pique the attendant's suspicions. Rathborn quickly apologized for his mistake, then exited the station as calmly as he could. A glance behind him reassured him he wasn't being followed. A few blocks away, he checked the timetable again. The train he had thought left in the evening had departed at 5 a.m. that morning, but there was a train at 8 p.m. Not wanting to be seen loitering, he bought a ticket to the cinema. The film was unmemorable, but the newsreel showing the macabre scene of the Kaiser's soldiers standing over Rathborn's fallen countrymen during the spring German offensive struck him to the core. The war had seemed at a remove during his time in prison. Minutes before 8 o'clock, he returned to the station and boarded his train. From his comfortable seat, he watched the fields and hills he had marched through that morning pass by in a blur. Jim Bennett and Peter Campbell Martin earned every mile it took to get to the border. They could take no unnecessary risks. There would be no train rides, no beers in pubs, no gifts of food. Neither of them spoke more than a few words of German. And if they ran into a patrol or villager out for a stroll, they would have to run or hide. Although they traveled only at night, they took special care nonetheless. They scouted every road and railway line, never crossing until they were sure it was clear. Bridges were forbidden territory, and any towns had to be circumvented, regardless of the distance required. When they spotted even the most harmless-looking civilian, they took cover and waited them out. As a further caution, they always walked 20 yards apart from one another. This kept their talking to a safe minimum, and if confronted from the front or behind, one of them would have the opportunity to escape. They often came across huts or barns that would have made for better, warmer lodgings than another hideout in the woods or in a field, but they resisted the temptation, fearing a farmer might discover them. They also kept a strict schedule of alternating watches during the day, while one of them slept. Despite all these measures, they were spotted by a policeman on a bicycle early in their flight to Holland. He shouted at them to stop, but even after he drew his pistol, Bennett and Campbell Martin ran, bolting in separate directions. In the moment of hesitation, it took the policeman to decide who to shoot. They both managed to get out of range. The policeman took off after Bennett on his bike. Bennett eluded him, but then an attachment of German army cavalry chased after him. Running faster than he ever had in his life, Bennett finally shook them loose. It took a while to reconnect with Campbell Martin, and by then he was too exhausted to go much farther. With incidents like this, and all their precautions, they were making slow progress on their 150-mile journey. Every hour they spent on the run heightened the risk of being captured. Equally troublesome, they had only limited food stores, and attempts to forage something to eat at the farms they passed proved fruitless. Their one hot meal a day was usually a fistful of oats mixed with OXO cubes, but they quickly understood that only stricter rationing would see them to the border without starving. Chapter 22. After their antics in Gellerson, Gray, Blaine, and Kennard slept in a copse of trees instead of attempting to cross the road to Artsen. They had barely left the woods after sundown on July 25th when they spotted a company of soldiers. Scrambling into the forest, they hid in the underbrush. They were close enough to the soldiers to see their bootlaces. Gray deciphered from their conversation that another patrol had nabbed an escaped prisoner down the road. There was nothing they could do to help him. After the soldiers had trailed away, Blaine struck his lighter, and Gray examined the map. Every alteration of their route was laden with compromise. A longer distance weighed against a smaller risk of encountering another patrol. Moving quickly down a roadside balanced against the safer but more taxing option of a hike through the countryside. They struck through some fields to circle around the soldiers before crossing at a well-hidden stretch of road. Then they marched on a northwestern course, at times cutting through farms and forested hillsides, at others keeping to the winding roads. Every couple of hours they took a break and smoked cigarettes, hands cupped over the ends so the orange glow was not seen in the dark. By sunrise the next day, as they headed toward Hohenhorn, they took advantage of some dense woods to hike on through the daylight and make up for lost time. Over the next two nights, much of the hours spent in a steady downpour, there were no main roads to follow. They took a yeoman's journey, down country lanes and muddy paths, halting often at the sight of soldiers and civilians who were clearly part of the Holzminden manhunt. They never stopped for any length of time, knowing well that a tracker or a bloodhound might be closing in on their trail. The patter of the rain was their only cover. As the bright red dawn of Sunday, July 28th, was breaking, they reached the outskirts of Exeter, only 36 miles from Holzminden as the crow flies. With the many twists and turns of their journey, they had trekked much farther in their five nights on the run, and they still had a long way to go. 24 hours earlier, Rathborn had arrived into Berba. After resting outside town, hiding himself in a stack of corn, he had a late breakfast of beer at a local tavern, listening to his waitress's bitter complaints about the shortage of potatoes. He then returned to the station and headed on to Fulda. His train came in too late for him to go straight to Cologne, so he bought a ticket to Frankfurt. He rode in a third-class carriage on a slow local train, as had been his plan. From experience, he knew that conductors and the police were much more rigorous in their inspections of express trains and better-class carriages than the ones he was on. The train stopped in almost every town along the route. A downside of third class, beyond the relative discomfort, was that it was full of chatty passengers with too much idle time on their hands. A German soldier on leave from the front railed against the nefarious Brits, and even thrust a propaganda leaflet, dropped by the RFC, into his hand. A young girl across from Rathborn chattered away as well. On his arrival at Frankfurt, he cleared out of the station as quickly as he could to avoid any chance encounters with the authorities. His gray suit was dirty, but that was nothing compared to his white shirt, which was so soiled he might well have spent the night in a coal mine. He stopped into a tailor's shop to replace it, but when asked what size he needed, he could offer only a blank stare, then made a fast exit. He had no knowledge whatsoever of German sizes. There was more trouble when he went to eat dinner at a restaurant. The garrulous owner said that he could not quite place his accent. Rathborn replied that he was Polish by birth, but he did not stay for dessert in case he had to explain any more about his background. The next couple of hours he spent in the cinema before it was time for his overnight train to Cologne. He slept fitfully on the 100-mile journey, arriving at the station on Sunday morning at 9 a.m. Although the skyline of Cologne was still dominated by the twin Gothic spires of its main cathedral, the city was in a sorrowful state. Most of the shops were shuttered, and those that were open, butcher, bakers, and grocers, had long lines snaking out the door. People on the streets had a forlorn gaze, and men, both young and old, hobbled past with war injuries. Concerned about his appearance, Rathborn visited a barber for a shave and a haircut. His next train, to Aachen, the spa town a mere 5 miles from the Dutch frontier, departed that evening. He spent the afternoon in parks, beer halls, and the cinema. He was becoming an expert in whittling away the hours, seen but unseen, and had become accustomed to presenting himself at the ticket booth, a travel-weary businessman who just wanted to get home. At 9 p.m., 2 hours after his train rumbled out of Cologne, Rathborn arrived into Aachen. He hopped on a tram that terminated at the Punt Tor, the medieval gateway northwest of the old city center. From there, he walked to the town's outskirts. He had a meal and a glass of gin at a small bar, fortifying himself for the last leg of his escape. Then he hid out behind a railway embankment. With map and compass in hand, he charted a route to the border that kept clear of any roads or villages. At 11:30 p.m., the sky completely dark, he stashed his valise by the embankment and started west. He had gone only a short distance and was walking through fields when a steady rain started to fall. The pitter-patter masked the sound of the crackling stalks underfoot. For an hour, he pushed his way through the crops. Then, all of a sudden, a pack of dogs started barking. He dropped down and laid flat, sure that the dogs were close enough to chase him out. When the dogs quieted, he heard the voices of soldiers. For a long while, he remained absolutely still as the rain soaked through his clothes, leaving his skin cold. Neither the barking nor the voices came any closer. Finally, Rathborn decided to move ahead. He crawled on his hands and knees, fallen corn stalks cutting his hands as he went. He heard soldiers now and again, but decided that his best chance was to continue. He was uncertain as to how far he had gone. With the dense stalks, it was slow going. On he crawled, hoping the border would come sooner than the pounce of its sentries. He must be so close now. On their own, or in bands of twos and threes, many of the tunnelers and the ruck were recaptured and returned to Holzminden. Captain Frank Sharp and Lieutenant Bernard Luscombe, numbers 28 and 29, out of the tunnel, were the first to come back through the gates. Niemeyer glowered at them as they passed. The two had made little preparation and had only a slim head start before the tunnel was discovered. Soldiers nabbed them 15 miles downriver on the banks of the Weser. With the return of each tunneler, the mood among the Holzminden prisoners darkened. Would any of the escapees manage the home run to Holland? Although filthy and stinking, Sharp and Luscombe were sent immediately to the cellars. No bath and no change of clothes were offered, and they were put on a bread-and-water diet. When Niemeyer finally appeared down in solitary, he was in a venomous mood. He removed Sharp's gold watch from his wrist and put it on the table. Then, using a knife, he stabbed and crushed the family heirloom into bits. He ordered the guard to tear the civilian outfits Sharp and Luscombe were wearing into ribbons. The two were left half-naked, with strict orders that nobody was to communicate with them, nor provide them with any additional food. As far as Niemeyer cared, they could rot in the cells. He promised to make that official with a court-martial. Others soon joined them. The police, soldiers, and bloodhounds sent out on the manhunt had less impact than the countless German citizens marshaled to look out for the escaped prisoners. Whether it was out of patriotism or greed for the reward, they were incredibly effective. Butler, the first out of the tunnel, was nabbed after he stole a bicycle in a village. Others were flushed out of fields or seized at crossroads. When guards brought in Murdoch and Lawrence, morale among the prisoners deflated. It looked like none of the fugitives would make it to Holland. By Monday, July 29th, 10 of the 29 escapees had been returned to the camp. The men's sorry states, grubby outfits, sallow faces, bodies narrowed from loss of weight, only further darkened the mood in the camp. Niemeyer swelled pridefully in his blue greatcoat with each recapture. Never one to let good fortune pass by, without boasting about his own hand in it, he shepherded in reporters to chronicle each return. They wrote down what Niemeyer dictated, with embellishments for color. Without exception, Niemeyer insisted that the prisoners had only succeeded in their escapes because of British accomplices outside the camp. There was an army of spies in the vicinity, he claimed, with no end to their abilities when it came to providing clothing, food, intelligence, and even a spare sapper or two. Although Niemeyer tried to wring a confession from the captured escapees, none of them admitted to even using the tunnel, let alone having dug it. All of his attempts to bribe the orderlies, cash included, into informing on the conspiracy and its members also failed. These efforts, and Niemeyer's abuse of the returned prisoners, stirred the pot of rebellion throughout Holzminden. Stokes Roberts believed that the mass escape would surely see Niemeyer removed from his position. But when General Hainisch sent an officer to investigate the events, he made clear that Niemeyer would stay. No war crime or level of incompetence seemed capable of dislodging him from power. Silent resistance continued nonetheless. One day, the officers lit cigarettes and pipes at roll call. Such was the amount of smoke that the parade ground looked like a bustling factory. Another day they refused to answer their names when called. Another day they came out bare-chested. Each time Niemeyer sent in his guards to herd them back into the barracks, each time with a little more violence. So many prisoners had been arrested for violations that they eventually had to be housed in the town jail. Niemeyer focused most of his attention on seeing the fugitives returned. By July's end, 15 prisoners remained out. But Holland was a long way away. By looking at where the other escapees had been caught, Niemeyer drew a bead on the remaining men's westward line of flight. Holzminden, Bodenwerder, Hameln, Lohne, Bielefeld, Ahaus, Gronau, and on to the Dutch border. He called for local assistance along that path. Even if the prisoners did find their way to the border, Niemeyer knew well that in their bedraggled and half-starved state, they would be easy pickings for the German sentries. He was confident that he would win out in the end. Then, one day while in the Kommandantur, he received a telegram sent from Holland. It was written by Lieutenant Colonel Charles Rathbone. It said, "Having a lovely time. Stop. If I ever find you in London, we'll break your neck. Stop." The first of the breakout artists had made it. Always careful, but as fast as they could manage. That was the maxim of Bennett and Campbell Martin. By dawn on July 31st, they had made up for their earlier slow pace, and the Dutch border was now only some 50 miles away. Another few nights of trekking,